This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
How low can they go? That was the question today for the Supreme Court about retail prices. Should manufacturers be able to set a minimum price that stores can't go below? Almost a century ago, the court said that amounted to price fixing. Today, the court changed its mind. We'll find out what it means. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. The Marketplace Health Desk is supported by the Commonwealth Fund, a private foundation working toward a high-performance health system, on the web at commonwealthfund.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, June 28th. Thanks for joining us. In 1911, the Supreme Court banned what are called minimum price agreements. These are deals between companies that make things and the retailers that sell them. For example, a TV manufacturer tells the electronics store its new TV has to sell for $1,000, not a penny less. The electronics store says, okay. Until a few hours ago, that kind of deal was illegal. But today, the Supreme Court overturned its 96-year-old decision. John Dimsdale looks at how this ruling might affect what we pay.
Disagreeing with today's decision, Justice Stephen Breyer writes it will likely raise the price of retail goods, but Quentin Riegel at the National Association of Manufacturers says not necessarily.
There will be some manufacturers that may try to do that, but manufacturers have to compete. Consumers demand lower prices, and in order to compete, manufacturers are going to have to meet that demand.
Riegel says pricing agreements between manufacturers and retailers can still be challenged on a case-by-case basis. For nearly 100 years, they've been automatically deemed illegal. He says now, product makers at least have the chance to convince a judge that a minimum price is pro-consumer. How can they argue that? Antitrust lawyer Jerry Gansfried says by showing price agreements will increase competition.
One of the great invitations for competitors to come in is the prospect of thinking that they can sell below somebody else's price. So you do get additional competition, you do get additional choice, and that's a large part of the rationale of this decision.
But Mark Cooper at the Consumer Federation of America says the onus is now on discounters who have to go to court to challenge the prices set by manufacturers.
It puts the burden of proof on the people most likely to do good for the consumer and least likely to have the resources to carry the case forward.
Cooper says this is the fourth Supreme Court decision in as many months to favor big business over consumers. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The court was working on business. The Senate decided not to do any business on immigration. A Senate vote today killed the chance of immigration reform anytime soon. President Bush called the death of his immigration plan a disappointment. A couple days ago, we told you about Venezuela's president seizing control of his country's oil fields. Hugo Chavez demanded oil companies sign a parting agreement and then get the heck out. ConocoPhillips and ExxonMobil said no. But they're still probably going to have to leave the country. Venezuela is taking over, deal or no deal. So with the U.S. companies on the way out, guess who might be coming in? China, according to a Bloomberg story today. We looked into it from our America's desk at WLRN. Here's Dan Gretsch.
Venezuela's state oil firm needs the help of outside companies to get its heavy crude oil out of the ground. Problem is, they just alienated ConocoPhillips and ExxonMobil, two firms that specialize in that sort of thing. Oil analyst Fadel Gate is with the Oppenheimer Group.
Basically, the Chinese want and need the oil, and Venezuela want and need an international partner. So it makes sense. The devil's in the detail, though.
Oil expert Jorge Piñon is at the University of Miami. He says if, as reported, China Petrochemical Corp. or the state-owned Sinopec Group enter Venezuela, they'll have their hands full.
The Chinese do not have any experience on heavy oil production. None.
Still, China seems willing to take the gamble, says Florida International University's Ed Glab.
The Chinese got a lot of money sitting out there in banks, so they can certainly afford the investment. Their economic success depends upon a secure supply of fuel.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is traveling the world looking for other partners. Today he's in Russia. His next stop? Iran. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Let's stay with oil a bit longer. We're on the hunt for alternatives to Middle Eastern oil. Could we find the answer in a petri dish? Today, the journal Science has some research on synthetic bacteria. Researchers believe these microbes could be turned into fuel. Sam Eaton reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
Scientists say the technology is still about a decade away from reaching your gas tank, but gene pioneer Craig Venter's success in transplanting the genetic code of one kind of bacteria into another is a huge scientific breakthrough that could eventually have profound economic implications.
What you're witnessing with this announcement is probably the birth of a new industry.
Juan Enriquez is co-founder of Synthetic Genomics, which has partnered with Venter. He says the ultimate goal is creating microorganisms from scratch with traits that could do everything from making biofuels to sucking up greenhouse gases.
You're beginning to think about taking what you know about life and assembling it a little bit in Lego blocks so that this plus this plus this will generate energy, or this plus this plus this will generate plastics.
Enriquez says even mild success would reap Goliath financial returns when it comes to creating new forms of energy. The company recently partnered with energy giant BP to do just that. It also filed for a patent. But as the science surges ahead, there's growing concern that government regulators need to do more to keep up. Art Kaplan chairs the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania.
You've got a situation where first, you do need to have safety and adequate oversight to make sure that synthetically engineered microbes don't wind up in places we don't want them to be.
Or in the hands of people like terrorists who could use the techniques to create superbugs. Kaplan says those obstacles can be resolved through careful oversight. What may prove more challenging, he says, are the philosophical implications. Is life special, or is it nothing more than a bunch of Lego blocks that can be rearranged at will? In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Some reporters at the Wall Street Journal didn't show up for work this morning. Their union is protesting Rupert Murdoch's bid for the newspaper's parent company, Dow Jones. Murdoch and Dow Jones are still working on a deal. No surprise from the Federal Reserve today. The Fed left its key interest rate at 5.25%. It hasn't moved in almost a year. We'll tell you how the markets reacted when we do the numbers. Today, the Census Bureau gave us the latest population figures for cities. Philadelphia has dropped out of the top five. It was replaced by Phoenix. Obviously a sign of the migration from north and east to south and west. But a lot of cities think they got cheated. They're planning to challenge the Census Bureau on its math. Joining us is John Talmadge. He's the CEO of a group called Social Compact. It tries to attract business to inner cities. He's in Miami right now talking with the mayor about challenging the Census Bureau. John, what's wrong with the count?
The census is the best measure we have to give you a national count. But what happens in underserved communities, there are issues of how they select the houses, whether the housing sheets are up to date. People have a natural sometimes have a natural fear of reporting their own information accurately to the Census Bureau. There are the census, because it's a once every 10-year count, they aren't able to interject new information that may come to light in those intervening years. So if the 2000 number is incorrect, then what gets built, what gets projected every year after that until the next census will also be incorrect.
Well, why does it matter if a city ranks fifth or sixth in population?
Well, I'm not sure that the ranking itself matters, but what does matter is that, according to the Brookings Institute, 80% of all private investment in the United States is based off or uses the census or census-derived information to make some of their decisions from. If you're a grocery store operator, you need to understand how many people live in that community, what is their discretionary income, how far will they have to travel to get to the grocery store. And so if you were to simply pull a census number, a 2000 census number for Detroit, you might believe that there's, 30, 40,000 people fewer in a community than actually live in that community today.
Have cities won these challenges?
Yeah, there were 41 successful census challenges last year, and I really commend the cities for conducting them. St. Louis has championed the census challenge for years. I think they've challenged successfully their census 8 years in a row. New York has done has had successful challenges. Mayor Mallory in Cincinnati is really beginning to take a national leadership role on organizing cities to conduct challenges from coast to coast.
But what happens when a city wins the challenge? Does the Census Bureau say, hey, we were wrong, here's a new list?
The census does not add the number to the national population. What the census does is to take the numbers that were added back to individual successful challenges from metropolitan areas that don't conduct challenges. In 2006, California had 100,000 people removed from their rolls as a consequence of not having conducted their own census challenges in different urban areas.
So why doesn't everybody challenge the numbers if they might lose population because somebody challenged?
Well, I think that there is a drumbeat. I think in 2001 there was two challenges, and that number has steadily increased until we got to the 41 last year. The U.S. Conference of Mayors has taken a very close look at this and how can they assist cities with challenges. They have been a champion of questioning the methodology for decades.
It sounds kind of like a game show. They should have like a penalty if you challenge and are wrong, or in football where you lose a timeout.
And, you're right. But what we all are striving for is to build the baseline so that when we get to the 2010 numbers, that there's a better understanding of what the urban population in the United States ought to be.
All right, John Talmadge, the CEO of Social Compact. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it.
Massachusetts is trying to make sure every person in the state has health care. No easy task. But the Massachusetts plan reaches another milestone this weekend. People who don't have insurance and make too much money to get help from the state can start buying coverage. This is for individuals making more than $31,000 and families making more than $62,000. Since Massachusetts won't be chipping in, the state's trying every which way to make this insurance affordable. Let's see how they're doing that. Helen Palmer has more from our health desk at WGBH.
Critics point out problems with Massachusetts' new system. The Health Connector Board, the folk who crafted it, point to success stories like Cheryl Greco.
I truly would say I believe that getting on the plan saved my life, and I will believe that to my dying day.
Greco's uncontrolled high blood pressure was causing heart problems until she signed up with Network Health. That's one of the insurers providing coverage at rock-bottom prices to the state's low-income population. So how low are the monthly premiums for Boston? Christina Severin, head of Network Health.
The price that the connector accepted from us was about $359, and outside of Boston, the price was $327.
There are no state subsidies, though, for people who earn more than 300% of federal poverty. But John Kingsdale, the head of the Health Connector Board, says monthly premiums are still affordable.
For the typical uninsured person in Massachusetts, who's a 37-year-old living in Boston, the total premium would range from $184 at the lowest price plan to about $290 for the higher-end premium.
The cheaper premiums come with deductibles and copays, but still undercut most workplace-based health insurance. Paul Hattis, a professor of health policy at Tufts University, tallied the cost of a high-end plan.
The plan through the Connector Board at the gold level was actually about $500 less between what I and my employer pay. So it's $500 of savings over what I'm getting through work on an annual basis.
So how have they done that? John Kingsdale of the Connector Board says they used several strategies to lower prices.
We're getting a broader cross-section of everybody, not just primarily sick people enrolling, and therefore we're able to, the health plans are able to price it more competitively. Secondly, we went through a bid process, and we were able, through that process, to get the prices down a little bit.
And finally, says Kingsdale, they've set the system up a bit like Travelocity, so people can log on to the Connector's website and price their options one against another. For the health insurers, getting prices down is also a matter of commitment. Deborah Enos of the insurer Neighbourhood Health Plan says their strategy is to use a tight network of primary care doctors.
We tend to work with a very defined, specialized primary care network, and that is one way that we have found to deliver cost-effective care. But we really wanted to have plan designs that encouraged, again, people to get into that core primary care management model.
Enos says investment upfront to manage chronic disease is the key to keeping people out of the emergency department and cutting costs later. It certainly worked for Cheryl Greco.
After I met with the doctor, he gave me tremendous advice, set me up on a pill, and within a month after seeing him, I haven't had the heart problems at all with this new medication. I can't even believe it.
Some aspects of the Massachusetts scheme could serve as a model for other states to bring down health spending. Competition between health insurers to deliver value, for example, and to get access to a new market among the previously uninsured. And since the healthy as well as the sick must buy insurance, costs are lower for the whole pool. But health policy expert Paul Hattis says there's a nationwide threat to the new system.
Health care costs have continued to grow, very near double-digit growth. And as that continues, it makes the entire healthcare costs to all of us just eminently unaffordable.
The latest figures predict U.S. health costs will rise almost 10% next year. As Hattis says, Massachusetts is only at first base so far. Getting to second will be a challenge. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Coming up, wrestling with the web for eyeballs in China.
Consumers are voting with their hands and clicking onto these sites as opposed to, you know, waiting for content on TV to become more interesting and compelling.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks finished nearly flat today after the Fed left interest rates unchanged. Traders seemed encouraged at first. Later, it looked as though they weren't sure what the Fed meant when it said core inflation improved modestly. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell a measly 5 points to close at 13,422. The NASDAQ edged up 0.3% to 2608. The S&P 500 was flat, closing at 1505. Intel rose 0.5% and Cisco 2% after both tech companies got upgrades. Analysts predicted stronger demand for some new products. GM shares climbed nearly 2% after the company reached a deal to sell off its profitable Allison transmission unit to a couple of private equity firms. Energy stocks rose after U.S. crude oil finished above $70 a barrel for the first time since September. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Duke University's Fuqua School of Business Executive MBA programs, where working professionals earn Duke MBAs from locations around the world. Online at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for May. Michigan University releases its consumer sentiment report for June. And 35 years ago, the Supreme Court outlawed the death penalty, calling it cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment. The ban lasted a little over 4 years. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Scott Jagow, in for Kai Rizdahl. That new gadget from Apple comes out tomorrow. Finally. People have been waiting in line since Monday at an Apple store in New York City. Some guy on Craigslist offered to camp out for you for $250. Now, one thing to keep in mind if you want to buy an iPhone, if you're not an AT&T customer, you'll have to switch carriers. And we all know how fun that can be. But there are ways. Janet Babin reports from our innovations desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
Web developer Adam Stewart can't wait to get his iPhone. He's never tried it, but he just trusts Apple to make elegant decisions, like allowing customers to activate their own phone over the internet instead of handing it over to a store clerk.
They didn't want some, you know, prepubescent, oily sales rep to, be getting their grubby little paws all over your brand new iPhone.
The only thing keeping Adam's paws from unwrapping his new iPhone is his current contract with Sprint. The iPhone only works if you sign up for a 2-year service plan with AT&T. The cost of cutting ties, $200.
I'm going to pay it. It's worth it to me.
But Adam's got a strategy to recoup some of his losses. He suggests signing up for AT&T service and getting one of its free or steeply discounted phones.
And then go out and buy iPhone. Put the iPhone on your account and sell the replacement phone on eBay.
Online blogs are teeming with ways to avoid paying the termination fee entirely. Ben Popkin at Consumerist.com has come up with 6 ways to leave your mobile network. Among them, check the fine print on your latest bill. Any fee increase could nullify your obligation. Or accuse your mobile carrier of poor service. Send complaints to the PUC and the Better Business Bureau. Then
CC everything to the company, create this big all nasty paper trail and wallpaper them until they're like, all right, let's get rid of this guy.
And if all else fails, Popkin has one final solution.
The last and definitely most desperate thing that you can do is die.
Yeah, not an option. A lot of customers will just end up paying to switch. But in a bit of karmic justice, analyst Daniel Berninger says Apple might soon be fighting to get out of its own contract. He's run the numbers and
AT&T will be getting a lot more revenue from the sale of iPhone than Apple.
And Apple's contract with AT&T is for 5 years, a lot longer than most consumer plans. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
In this country, a lot of young people like reality television. In China, TV has a little too much reality. China's government isn't exactly the Fox network when it comes to programming. So venture capitalists are pouring millions of dollars into creating Chinese shows for the internet. One privately owned broadcaster in Hong Kong has come up with a new program. It's certainly real and most definitely provocative. Jocelyn Ford reports from Beijing.
In a stuffy makeshift studio on a college campus, the host of China's first gay talk show is excited about making history. But his immediate concern is how to survive the hour-long webcast without air conditioning.
Nice to meet you.
You always feel hot?
Yeah, sure.
27-year-old Didier has a day job teaching French. He comes to the studio once a week for the 12-episode talk show. Today's topic is about gay love. Didier says he's ready to answer any question, even if it gets private.
maybe they will talk about something about my private life.
That's considered radical because only 4 years ago, China officially regarded homosexuals as mentally ill. Most TV stations in China are government-run, and they still don't dare touch homosexuality. But the private Hong Kong company, Phoenix New Media, sees the social outcasts as a marketing opportunity. Li Ya is marketing director. He casts his talk show as a trailblazer.
We have to do certain shows which is regarded as innovative and pioneering.
So far, the strategy is paying off. Newspapers and magazines have written widely about the new media company's daring do. But using controversy to draw viewers online can cut both ways. It could alienate conservative viewers who still watch the company's TV station. And it could alienate the government censors. Li Ya says he convinced the censors the show would be socially useful because it addresses AIDS prevention.
We had some internal debate. We discussed the risk of irritating certain group of people. The traditional value, family value of Chinese society does not accept gay as a viable way of life.
After all, Chinese tradition dictates a good son must have a wife who can bear a male heir. So many homosexuals marry to avoid shaming their parents. In this episode, DDA is trying to show gay men can also have meaningful personal relationships with other men. He tells how his former boyfriend proposed eloping to Canada to get married. It's the sort of sensational romance that would attract young viewers. And that's the audience Phoenix New Media is chasing. There are about 140 million internet users in China, trailing only after the United States. Most of them are under 30, and most of them go online for entertainment and information before turning to the boob tube. Media consultant Duncan Clark says Chinese TV censors are inadvertently pushing youth to the internet because government-controlled TV programs are so dull.
Consumers are voting with their hands and clicking on to these sites, as opposed to, you know, waiting for content on TV to become more interesting and compelling.
The problem Phoenix TV shares with U.S. broadcasters is once the audience is on the internet, how do you make them pay?
The big challenge of the internet in China is that people expect everything to be free. The biggest restraint on growth of online video content available exclusively online is the business model. Who's going to pay for the content?
At Phoenix New Media, Li Ya doesn't have the answer. But he says the first step is to generate an audience. His goal? To turn Phoenix into the brand known for edginess. After homosexuality, Phoenix plans to address Buddhism, which, along with other religions, is still considered a sensitive subject by Chinese censors. In Beijing, I'm Jocelyn Ford for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, maybe it's a good time to go on a diet. No, we're not saying you're fat. It's just that so many foods are dangerous these days. Today, a kind of vegetable chip was yanked from the shelves. The FDA thinks about 50 people may have gotten sick from eating veggie booty. Yes, that is the name of it. There might have been salmonella in the popular snack. And the FDA is also recalling some seafood from China. Might have antibiotics in it. Chinese toothpaste, tires, pet food, seafood. Hey. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 5 points, just a blip. The NASDAQ ticked up 0.3%, and the S&P 500 was flat. Our editors include John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the program, big business is eating into small business contracts. The little guy's fighting back.
There's been 3 federal investigations now that have found fraud as one of the reasons why large firms are getting small business contracts.
I'm Scott Jagow. Please join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.